WBAI.org. On that website, you can find out how to become a member of this radio station, a financial supporter of this station to help sustain WBAI. Give us a call now at 212-209-2950. Make that call, make that contribution in support of Democracy Now!, in support of WBAI. It's 9 a.m. in New York City. Again, this is 99.5 FM WBAI. Coming up next, Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg.
Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out.
This is Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize for another world as possible, and we are the ones to make it so. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Later on, racism is routine, not aberrational. Rewriting and writing the myth of American exceptionalism by critical race theory. But first, on May 9, 1981, the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Security and Terrorism was debating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. Their goal? Criminalize the unauthorized identification of U.S. intelligence agents. Then Senator Joe Biden rose to his feet to denounce, "My father," says Chris Agee, Philip Agee, the CIA whistleblower whose 1975 book Inside the Company identifies some 250 officers, front companies, and foreign agents working for the United States. Biden stated, "I do not think anybody has any doubt about Mr. Agee. We should lock him up, in my opinion." Philip Agee had become public enemy number one after publication of his book. He also became the victim of a disinformation and harassment campaign that forced him to live on the run for the rest of his life. Philip Agee was a whistleblower, revealing the crimes of the agency, the CIA, and those who perpetrate the crimes of U.S. empire and perpetuate it. He became a dissenter, whistleblower, a model to follow. Philip Agee's truth-telling and activism are to be heralded and followed, as there is a truism he instructed us in. American democracy cannot exist regardless of the laws that have been used to safeguard or keep it quiet without dissent. Now, Chris Agee, editor of Covert Action magazine, thank you for joining us.
This tradition in terms of identifying the injustices of our society goes way back to even the founding in the efforts to address grievances that the colonists had against the British monarchy. This tradition is very important in terms of developing the foundations and principles and values upon which this country is founded. We shouldn't neglect to mention that this country essentially was founded on top of a society and societies that already existed here. And that clearly presents a sort of hypocritical theme here, which we can highlight. While on the one hand, this country is founded on certain principles, On the other hand, the actions it takes, of course, is otherwise. And so it becomes all the more important for us to identify those injustices and the unequal treatment that the people who live in this part of the world experience. So in that tradition, it becomes very important, and as you say, in maintaining and establishing a democratic and just society, that people identify these injustices. So in that sense, that's very much what my father, Philip Agee, was doing after he learned that what he was doing in the CIA was to not follow along those principles that he himself grew up on. And it was in the practice of engaging in activities in other countries, for example, that he began to notice that what he was doing was not actually bringing what he thought, as he had been educated to believe, bringing freedom and democracy to people in other countries, but rather it was to serve as the secret policeman for multinational corporations, to create favorable investment climates for multinational corporations. And so as he looked around living in Latin America as he was stationed, he noticed that there was a tremendous amount of poverty and that what they were actually doing was gathering lists of so-called subversives. These are typically people who were like trade unionists, human rights, people who are involved in helping the poor and so on, and organizing to try to make their societies more democratic. As he began to understand those injustices and lack of equal opportunity in the countries that he was working in, he was also noticing the injustices in the United States. This was during the 1960s, the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement. It just became part of his understanding that what he was actually doing was in contrast to what he had been told he would be doing. So he decided to quit, went public, wrote a book, and exposed the activities of the CIA. The important point to understand is his message. We can divide that into kind of three different areas. One is CIA tradecraft, where he identifies the activities, goes into describing the foreign intelligence collection, counterintelligence activities, and the various covert actions that went on. Also,
Philip Agee, of course, revealed the machinations of the workings of the CIA, but he also revealed the names of individuals working within the agency. So he took it out of this kind of almost intellectual critique of the CIA and took it right down to holding responsible those people who were bureaucrats and functionaries and the agents provocateurs throughout the world's community who were doing these dastardly deeds. And for that, he paid his price. Now, once again, we see a book that was published in May, in fact, by former National Security Council advisor Jonathan Stevenson, who said that CIA whistleblower Philip Agee is treasonous. And I mention this because on top of it, in June, on the 50th anniversary of the publication of the Pentagon Papers, the New York Times, which had surprised me, maybe it shouldn't have, but it published an op-ed, hatchet job, a vicious one, on Daniel Ellsberg, arguing that his actions were an assault on democracy. How do we deal with that? How do we understand the venomous attack now? And I'm saying these actions of the Philip Agees and the Daniel Ellsbergs and so on are heroic and have been since the inception of this country, those who revealed the crimes of U.S. empire. But they're saying they're treasonous, they're undemocratic. How do you respond to that and help us understand the nature of your continuing work, which is indeed to reveal the crimes of U.S. empire and to protect and support the whistleblowers and the dissenters that have emerged and we hope will continue to?
Indeed, this is yet another attack on people who blow the whistle, and it's important that we understand the difference between treason and blowing the whistle. For example, we have perhaps if there's somebody who steals secrets and sells them to a foreign power, we might call that treasonous. But that's very different from a whistleblower who sees that the activities of a particular organization, be it a government or a corporation, they're doing things that are hurting people, undermining the at least espoused principles upon which those institutions are founded. Whistleblowers are very useful to alert the public and alert the power structure in those institutions about what they're doing. But what's important to understand is that we need people who are identifying these injustices and who go public. So in that sense, it's very important for us to understand the motives behind why people go public. So understanding Stevenson and his book, where he which entitled "A Drop of Treason." As you go through the book, it seems that the way that Stevenson approaches these matters, and of course he's a former NSC advisor himself, the way that they look at the activities or the of whistleblowers, or the case of my father, is that they look at the world in a very binary way, sort of the dichotomy between good and evil. There's the good capitalist democratic model, the way they see it, and then there's the evil empire or the sort of communist tyrannies out there, and you're either on one side or the other. What's important to understand about my father, in addition to describing the CIA tradecraft and what he actually did in the CIA in detail by naming names and so on and so forth. As to your question earlier about naming names, he felt that it was really important to actually name the names of people, because how do you separate these criminal acts from the actual people who do it? So in that way, he really thought that instead of just writing sort of a fictional book of this is how it works, or a sort of a description of what's happening, he thought that it was really important to take on the institution and stop it from continuing to do those things. So in that sense, it's really important to understand what he was doing with respect to identifying and naming names. But what's also important to understand about what he was doing, and anybody who does a review on the internet of his speeches or reads his books and his articles, you will readily find what he presents as the economic and political circumstances in which we are living, and the historical circumstances of how we got here. That is part and parcel of his message. It's not as simple as this black and white binary between good and evil. In fact, I can tell you a little story about when I came home one day. I was about 15 years old. I was in history class in high school in Germany. It was an international school. And I came home with this flyer, like this sort of worksheet handout. And it had these two big circles of like the West and the East, or the Soviet Empire and the U.S. Allies. And the title of the worksheet was called something like "The Bipolar World." And I brought it to my dad and I said, "What's this about? How can I better understand this?" Started going into a much more complex analysis that went beyond this binary approach of understanding the world. And this is what Stevenson is essentially the prism from which he sees my father, and he wrote this book, his biography on my father, is the world is sort of divided into these camps. And what my father was explaining to me was that it's more complicated than that. And I think a lot of people in the United States suffer from that same simplistic view of the world. This more complex view goes into taking a look at for example, impoverished countries. How did they get to become impoverished? You go through the historical analysis of any given country, and you can understand the colonialism that existed, the neo-colonialism that then transpired. You also, the class, the issues around class, race, gender, that go on in these countries. And when you do that analysis in a much more detailed way, you begin to understand, especially as you look at the history, that oftentimes in these countries, people have this sort of indigenous movements that are attempting to bring more equal rights and justice, as your program is called, right? Sort of more democratic processes in those countries, so that they can use the resources of those countries to implement, the development, utilize their labor, all of that kind of stuff to develop their countries for themselves. And so what my father did is he came along and with his experience of having worked in security services, repressing local populations, working with local police, rounding up people that were organizing to make their countries more democratic, he describes in a much more clear way the situations in these countries and the effects of U.S. imperialism and economic control and also the political environment. That in that way, his descriptions are much more clear in describing what's happening. And that's the part where Stevenson and others who attacked my father, that's the problem that they essentially suffer from. It's a very binary way of looking at the world. How could he possibly have left, you know, the good side and gone to the bad side? That's not what he did at all. What he didn't go to the bad side. He went to the side of people and their interests, and not just the corporations and the wealthy.
Well, I think actually it's even more insidious and dangerous than that in terms of what Jonathan Stevenson really sought to do in his book, A Drop of Treason, and that is to kind of siphon out the good whistleblower or the whistleblower who does no harm from the whistleblower and the dissenter who seeks to really dismantle the people perpetrating the harm and dismantle the agency and with it the ideology that furthers the creation of the deep state, of the national security state, of the CIA and its various, and of course, those who make it run. And I think it was particularly interesting that you wind up with a book like that at this point that's trying to alienate people from a number of individuals using Philip Agee as its root. I don't remember in the last 5 years of more of whistleblowers than we have in many of the previous years. And we are on the eve of Daniel Hale's July 27th sentencing for exposing the inner truths of the drone war. 90% of casualties are civilians. And we know of Edward Snowden and Julian Assange arguing their respective cases. So there's a much greater kind of conspiracy of the state in many ways that may have even encouraged Jonathan Stevenson to publish his book. But that whole concept that there are the soft, better ways of you can critique the state and its various apparatus. You can critique the crimes of U.S. empire, but you can't seek to rectify them, and you can't certainly seek to dismantle them. That in fact, the Stevensons want these agencies to continue in place. And what the AGs did is they're saying, no, it's not a matter of reforming. They're rotten to the core and destructive to humanity. I mean, is that in many ways how you see the kind of work that they did, these people that we've mentioned, the purpose also of perhaps Stevenson's book, to as the public was acclimating and upholding as great champions of liberty, the Daniel Hales and the Chelsea Mannings and the Assanges and so on. Do you think that, in fact, we should understand this book and this time as a way of pushing back at the American people's desire to know the intimacies and viciousness of U.S. empire and, indeed, strike out against it?
Absolutely. These blinders that, in this sort of binary view of the world, they're missing the actual message by saying that there are good whistleblowers and bad whistleblowers. I would firstly say that whistleblowers are, a lot of them are doing excellent work by calling out the injustices that they're seeing. But what was particularly unnerving for Stevenson and people like my father and perhaps to a certain degree Snowden, where he calls them bad whistleblowers and then others, the good whistleblowers, that don't really question the fundamentals of the system. That's really what they're doing. That's what Stevenson is doing. He's missing the message of what he calls the so-called bad whistleblowers that are questioning the fundamental structural injustices, saying that they have rejected or betrayed the American project. People like Stevenson then just go to these attacks on, like my father, that he was some kind of double agent, or that he was, you know, involved in drinking and womanizing and so forth, and having psychological problems. what they do is they delve into that kind of narrative instead of actually taking on the message, which is about imperialism and political economics of how multinational corporations need access to resources to the countries that corporations want. And then, of course, there's the analysis of the domestic situation, this gargantuan military budget, the whole analysis from the late 1940s and the development of the CIA, the National Security Council, and the understanding that after the Second World War, the rulers in this country were worried about a return to the Great Depression. They needed markets for their products, so they went into developing ways of countering the efforts in other countries that were being made to democratize those societies and their resources. So he creates an analysis here that describes the actual rationale of the CIA and describing the true nature of U.S. imperialism. And it's that which Stevenson objects to, calls him a bad whistleblower. So you're a bad whistleblower when you go to the depths of really describing, you know, the emperor has no clothes. And then the other whistleblowers, who I would emphasize, are doing good work. Whistleblowers like Bill Binney, Chelsea Manning, and so on, who have gone to a great danger to go public and describe what's going on. But it was what my father was doing that was so useful as a model for all of us to learn from. And that is that we need to develop not only an understanding of what's happening, but in terms of what's being done, the spycraft, the tradecraft, we also need to understand the political, economic, and social analysis of what's happening here, and also understand in a historical context. We also need to engage in solidarity. And that's what my father spent his life doing, getting involved in organizations and with people and networking internationally and nationally, organizing around these issues and doing their best to take on the injustices and speaking truth to power.
How is the work of your father and our tribute and our acknowledgement of the importance today of supporting our whistleblowers, our dissenters, and understanding that there are enormously frightening laws that are being used to silence them and to chill anybody who would reveal the crimes of U.S. empire. Certainly there's the issues of the 1917 Espionage Act used against first Daniel Ellsberg and Julian Assange now. There was the imprisonment for Chelsea Manning and torture within prison as well. And of course, as I said, we are on the eve of the sentencing of a hail, terrible thing. So tell us about the work of Covert Action magazine and what needs to be and must be done to uphold this tradition and indeed encourage it and see it as the most wonderful, wonderful form of servicing democracy, shall we say, rather than serving or being a patriot to one's country.
Absolutely. We really need that kind of analysis that identifies the covert actions that are going on around the world, puts these covert actions into context by describing the political economic analysis that surrounds these different covert actions. What's going on behind the scenes? To the best extent we can, describe the role that the United States plays in other countries. It's important for us to also highlight the history that has brought these particular countries and events that surround these events. And so in that sense, it's really important that we have a magazine that does that. And of course, Covert Action has been doing that since 1978. It's really important that we carry on that tradition. We are encouraging particularly people from the Global South, from the areas that where the United States is actively involved in undermining democratic processes. And we are encouraging people to write for us that would identify what's going on behind the scenes. It's really important to do this right now because, as many of your listeners are probably familiar with Bill Bloom's work, one particular book he wrote called Killing Hope, which is a description of the history of U.S. intervention. He spoke at one of our events a couple of years back, and he described something that really struck a chord with me. And that is that in all my efforts with all my students and all my friends and neighbors and everyone who I interact with in the United States and even in different parts of the world, is that there's this sense that no matter what you tell people about torture, about surveillance, about oppression, about intervention in elections, about coup d'etats, bribery, all of the activities of covert action, no matter how far you go into detail about all of the stuff, the bombings, the drone wars, and so on and so forth. For example, like Daniel Hale has exposed the drone war for what it truly is, whereby 90% of the casualties are civilian. No matter what you tell people, oftentimes there's a sense that the leaders or so-called rulers, right, the rulers who are involved in making the decisions to carry out these things, they must mean well. There's this notion that sort of like belief. So it's so important that we document these activities and just continue to present day after day what is really going on behind the scenes so that people, even though they may still continue to have that knee-jerk reaction that they must mean well, I think it's our job to provide a forum for people to identify these injustices, including whistleblowers who are involved in these, and to keep telling the truth and speaking truth to power. So that's what we're trying to do at Covert Action. We're also trying and working with young people and young writers to help train them in doing this kind of work, which is really important. That's what we're doing to take this on. I tell my students three things to keep in mind. One is to educate yourself about what's going on. Second is to educate those around you to the best you can. Third, to get involved, because taking on the state, trying to rectify these injustices, it's not that easy to do it alone. What we all need to do is be getting involved in organizations. Pick your issue that's important to you. Get involved, because we have much more impact when we work in a united fashion.
Tell us about the extraordinary forum that's coming up and tell us how we can register to participate in it.
On Monday, July the 26th, we're going to have a webinar with Daniel Ellsberg speaking about Philip Agee as a model for today's whistleblowers and dissidents. The webinar is going to be at 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Monday, July the 26th, which is on the eve of Daniel Hale sentencing, which will be on July 27th. And so it becomes all the more important for us to analyze what is a whistleblower and why do they go public. And so it's going to be very interesting to hear from Daniel Ellsberg and his views on the matter, as well as from Colonel Ann Wright, myself, and Lewis Wolf, who worked with my father for many decades and helped co-found Covert Action magazine back in the 1970s. For those of you who want to join this webinar, all you have to do is send an email to register@covertactionmagazine.com. I'll say that again. It's register@covertactionmagazine.com. And if you have any questions about the event or want to just find it on the internet, just go to our website, which is covertactionmagazine.com, and you'll find the information there. And so I think it's a really exciting to be able to interact with these folks and discuss my father's message and to emphasize the analysis that he provided us with so that we can learn from that model and also encourage others to identify and go public on the injustices that governments and corporations are involved in. And because it's all the more important that we do that and we provide a supportive environment for people to do that. So that's what the idea of this exciting webinar on Monday is about.
And I really would be remiss as we, you know, have just skimmed the surface and looking at the contributions of Philip Agee and his exposure of the CIA. But also let's put a human face on this and an understanding of the toll for whistleblowers in actual human costs and terms. Talk just a little bit of the sacrifice of Philip Agee.
Having him as a father where from the point of view of the son, it was so often that clear that my father was worried about being assassinated at any time. We kind of lived under that kind of cloud. Secondly, our mail would always arrive back then before the internet. It was in envelopes that were, you could clearly see that they had been steamed open and then reshut. So we were being surveilled. So in that sense, it's kind of, you know, a scary thing to think that you're being followed and you're being surveilled. Financially, for example, is another aspect of this, which was that essentially lived in very difficult circumstances financially. It was just by luck in different occasions that, for example, he married into a relationship where his wife, my stepmother, happened to have a job and was able to keep us afloat in that respect. Financially, it was really difficult to grow up in this circumstance. The stress around being surveilled and other more nefarious things happening was always a cloud that made for quite a stressful family situation. The other thing, my father was very concerned oftentimes when he was walking around or going down the street or traveling to different countries and passing through customs. It was oftentimes the case that these were very stressful experiences. And so in that sense, it really is a high cost that you definitely pay when you go public. But on the other side, there's a tremendous amount of a feeling of it's a sort of a solidarity with other people that you're on the right side of history, that you're doing the right thing. These are the things really that were meaningful to him in terms of motivating him to do what he did. So while there's a lot of costs, there's a lot of benefits too. You can actually, you know, on the other hand, rest well in the sense that you've done the right thing.
Chris Agee, editor of Covert Action magazine, we'll see you at the forum, Exposing U.S. Empire, Philip Agee as a Model for Today's Whistleblowers and Dissidents. Thank you for joining us. Let's take a moment to listen to the iconic whistleblower dissenter, Philip Agee.
We have government agencies like the Congress, the Senate Committee, for example, to oversee the CIA, talking about the agency now being under control and that the abuses of the past have now been eliminated, as if the agency wasn't under control all along, and as if what they call abuses weren't ordered by presidents. The main argument is not with the agency, which is an instrument for policy execution, but the main argument is with the president and the people outside the CIA who determine the interests which have to be protected and how, who determine American foreign policy and then call upon the CIA and other agencies to execute that policy. What I would like to know, and I know many other people would like to know too, is not only the history, but the current relations between the CIA and the SADC in Iran, for example. Imagine all the Iranians who would like to know that. With the Kokantib in Indonesia. Imagine the 100,000 political prisoners or so in Indonesia right now who are being held without trial and have been some for over 10 years by this security service, which has had its history of relationships with the CIA. Whether the institutional relationship continues with the Korean CIA right now, with the DINA in Chile, with the DOPS and the CODI and the other organizations in Brazil, with the Uruguayan security services, with the Argentine Federal Police there. All of these relationships of the past probably continue to today in one degree or another. And I don't see how the Carter administration or any other administration can talk about human rights while these institutional contacts remain and while these services receive in one degree or another, support, guidance, and encouragement from the CIA.
You were listening to whistleblower, dissenter, Philip Agee. Now, critical race theory. We're sick and tired of the lie of American exceptionalism and the liberal civil rights discourse premised upon the ideals of assimilation, color blindness, and integration, says Dr. Sam Anderson, a founding member of the Black Panther Party, an activist within the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and the Black Arts Movement of the 60s. He became one of the first Black Studies directors in 1969 when he was hired to chair Sarah Lawrence College's Black Studies program. Dr. Anderson, the latest cultural war is against critical race theory, a backlash no doubt to the millions of Black Lives Matters, boots on the ground worldwide advocating for racial justice in all spheres of life, institutionally and attitudinally, and against the symbols of white supremacy. Darn. They were intent on upsetting the whole apple cart of control and power in the society in the wake of the killing of George Floyd.
I first would like to put a historical context on where we are from the point of view of Professor Carol Anderson. I don't think she's related to me. Maybe she is down the road through slavery, but... Sister Carol had a book she published a few years back called Eyes Off the Prize, in which she documented how the Black liberation struggle of the 19th century and the Garvey movement and all of the radical African Blood Brotherhood, all those different radical movements in the North and in the South were consolidating themselves around the struggle for human rights. That's why William Monroe Trotter went to the League of Nations. That's why after the League of Nations, Du Bois and a number of other people went to the United Nations to appeal to the world that the issue of Black people's freedom is centered around the struggle for human rights within the United States. And what Sister Carol Anderson points out in the book is that the elements in the white ruling class feared that whole approach of internationalizing the Black liberation or the Black freedom struggle through the lens of human rights. They began to defund or red bait those people who were involved in that struggle, directing a lot of the NAACP, the newly formed Urban League, and so forth to do quote-unquote civil rights aspects. That is to say, to use the bourgeois laws that exist to tweak the fundamentals of capitalist law to appease a certain element in among Black folk. And so we wind up with the civil rights movement. And in 1960, the students got involved in a sit-in movement that took off, and they created the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1960. By 1965, 5 years later, the SNCC, those students were radicalized through their experiences with the hypocrisy of the bourgeois Democrats and the virulent racism they faced, violent both North and South, and they started to go along, agree with, and support the concept that Malcolm X was laying out, and that was our Black liberation struggle, our Black freedom struggle, our struggle for justice is a struggle around the issue of human rights. So here we are today, to make a long story short, trying to define our struggle again through the lens of the civil rights movement, and that has been completely exhausted. The NAACP is out of it. The Urban League is out of it. All of the Black politicians, the elected officials that got elected through the struggles of our people are all caught up in the right-wing elements within the Democratic Party. Their class allegiance is more to the 1% than it is to Black folk in general. So the movement has been weakened while the right has consolidated itself since the wave that came out of the Tea Party in opposition to Obama and built up from the Tea Party to the craze cult thing that Trump has produced over the past 6 years. So here we are dealing with this issue of so-called critical race theory madness, right? It's a trope. It's a ruse created by the right to smother and misinform and disinform not only Black students and Black people in general, but white people. to lay out that any discussion of the systemic realities of racism in this country, both historically and present, is a discussion that was created by communists. And as you know, communists are worse than the devil. Right? We would dialogue with the devil, the right says, but we would never dialogue with communists. So you have this big bugaboo created, and you have people going out foaming at the mouth at school board meetings and going to the library and telling them to throw out certain books and going on social media, spreading lies in the same fervent way that they spread lies about COVID-19 and the vaccination. Here we are at this moment, we meaning the forces in the Black liberation movement, the Black struggle, are at a weak point, and we have to reconsolidate ourselves and begin to push back against this onslaught.
Dr. Anderson, let me also ask you to put in context the whole question of education and education of and for oppressed people, which has always been seen as a great corrector and struggled against since the times of slavery, where your life was virtually in jeopardy if there were efforts to educate, to read, to advance people by virtue of the knowledge, including, of course, the capturing and recitation of knowledge from one's homeland, where one had been arrested from, dragooned from, taken in chains from. So we go from there to the evolution of fighting in the 60s and 70s for ethnic studies, for Black studies, etc. And now we have the terminology critical race theory. Indeed, what is the issue around education, and how do we view critical race theory as perhaps just the latest backlash or effort to preclude the education as it is self-determined, including looking back at the valiant efforts for community control of education that have been part of the Black freedom struggle?
That's it in a nutshell. Our history of the education of Black folk has been a history of education for liberation, for the most part, becoming educated to counter the racist misconceptions that are fed to everybody, including us, to counter our racial inferiority complexes. So Black educators during slavery clandestinely and during the Reconstruction period and all the way up through the present, serious Black educators were looking at how do we educate our people so that they are able to stand strong and fight the good fight to realize our freedom. There has always been a pushback by the ruling class against that, always. Little examples, but very important. The independent Black schools that came up during Reconstruction that were funded primarily by Northern white philanthropists, they funded it, funded many of them, and said, this is what we want you to teach. We want you to teach them how to be good workers, teach them how to be good craftsmen, period. A good seamstress, period. And oftentimes in these small schools that were run by Black folk and hardly ever visited by the white folks who gave them money, they were doing the opposite or doing both. They were both teaching skills, working class skills and so forth, but also teaching them critical thinking skills. And whenever they said, you're not supposed to teach Latin, many of these schools taught Latin because that was the that was what white folks were doing in their schools and their elite schools and so forth. So there's always been this undercurrent of teaching, educating on the down low and schooling in the public light or training in the public light or schooling in the public light, but educating in the down low. And this is reflected in many of the surviving HBCUs, the same kind of double thing that was happening in those schools. Very sophisticated. Thurgood Marshall could not have become who he was without going through Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. Langston Hughes, the same thing. So we have that history of educating Black people successfully in all categories of education. There's always been white pushback, white liberal pushback, white reactionary pushback. And now in 2021, the liberal elements have been kicked to the curb because of the wave of right-wing madness that had that took shape, as I mentioned before, over the past 10, 12 years and consolidated itself in within a certain element of the ruling class that had to be funded, to be organized, to write legislation, to hire people in certain areas, fire people in certain areas, and to begin to shape what they want to see in education. And like I said, they want to see a whitewashed, literally a whitewashed history of the U.S. and the world, in which the benevolence of white people freed black people from hard labor. They wouldn't even use the word slavery.
Now, just let's add a caveat to that. You have people like, unfortunately, Gary Knoll on WBAI as a critic and allowed to continue his rants against critical race theory, who say that, in fact, if not Gary, but other people who are perceived of as liberal, I would certainly say that description belies, is not accurate to their positioning on race. People who repudiate critical race theory are white supremacists and imbued with the privilege of 400 years of the system of plantation capitalism that controls people by white supremacy and relegates a relative privilege to white people to benefit them as the continuing forces of this reactionary system. They very often, or some number of them, will say, but wait a minute, it's almost a class division. We want to build a sense of solidarity and humanity, and to build humanity, we can't preference one allegedly over another, or we can't just not continue to understand America in the context not of 1619, as was alleged to be the first arrival of a slave ship by Nicole Henry Jones. We have 1776 as the moment of conceptual democracy upon which this nation was alleged to be founded. Ah, yes, the myth of American exceptionalism must continue for us to build a humane and collective society to realize the promise of democracy. So how do you respond to those people who repudiate critical race theory on that basis?
First thing is that critical race theory is a subject that's taught in law school, never taught in K through 12 school. In other words, it's an advanced subject that looks at the law and shows that race rules the law, to make a long story short. And Derrick Bell was one of the founders of that in the 1970s up at Harvard. And a number of other people have followed through. Crenshaw was a sister who
Kimberly
wrote about
Crenshaw
it.
Kimberly Crenshaw and Pat Williams. Yeah.
Right. And anyway, advanced theoretical topic in law. And what the right has done is, because it has a rhythm to its phrase, critical race theory. And it's for them, they are deeply anti-intellectual in terms of the public. And so theory is an intellectual thing. The elite deal with theory, and they're always criticizing something, and it's always about race. So they use that phrase and flipped it to be anvil, if you will, on progressive education in the United States in the public school systems. And people need to understand, nobody teaches critical race theory K through 12. Rarely in college. Most of the time, it's in grad school, in law school, for the most part. Anyway, that's one thing. The second thing is, when we look at history in terms of North America, there were enslaved Africans in North America before 1619, complements of the Dutch, in a place called New Amsterdam is one of the places they settled, and they settled with enslaved Africans. Where is New Amsterdam? Well, we call it New York City today. And the Dutch had enslaved not only Africans in New Amsterdam, but all the way up the Hudson River, wherever they settled and negotiated with the Native Americans or killed them off, They had enslaved Africans with them. So 1619 is not the first time. It's the first time that the British colonies had it. Because you also had in the South, in Florida, Spanish coming in with enslaved Africans also for a while. And that predated 1619. Even if we talk about 1776, I would suggest that people read several books by Professor Gerald Horn, who deals with that period of the United States, the making of the U.S. and the period of 1776 and that whole period. And the thing that he lays out in his work, I think it's three books in that, the Senate on that, is that 1776 was primarily a consolidation of power by slaveholders against the British who were talking about ending slave trade and possibly even ending slavery within their lifetime, that period in the late 1700s. So their primary purpose to come together was to save the institution of chattel slavery. And they fought the British around that. Gerald Horn documents that, documents the whole reality that if black people joined the fighting forces of the British, that they would automatically be free. That never happened within the confines of the American Revolutionary Army. Even though they were free blacks who fought, obviously, on the side of the American Revolution. And they were also unfree blacks who fought on the side of the American Revolution because of the promises that were made about this thing called democracy and freedom that they were going to establish. They soon realized after the triumph of the American Revolution that it was a ruse. It was a false thing. So 1776, even if we start there, even if we start with our history of the United States in 1776, we see race at the base of the development of a newly formed capitalist nation.
Right-wingers are taking over library boards to remove books on racism. Ferocious attacks on public libraries and their programming. And of course, this is not unrelated to the ongoing attacks on teachers and public schools, Black Lives Matter organizing, the teaching of U.S. history, which dubbed the teaching now of critical race theory, and the backlash also against the LGBTQIA plus community, and particularly trans Absolutely. People. So how do you finally understand and assess the work of progressives in response to the ferocity of all things educational and near precipice of book burnings?
Yes, there are contemporary book burnings. Yeah, I think the progressive forces, we made too many assumptions about the liberal elements within the 8 years of the Obama administration. And many of us got lulled into thinking that social reform, education reform is on its way, that and that there are elements within the whole governmental apparatus, both local, county, state, and national, that were fundamentally supportive of these progressive aspects, the fight back that was taking shape rethinking standardized testing is one thing that in 8 years people made that assumption that that was going to continue. The advances being made in terms of fighting against racist textbooks that were being established in Texas was another thing. With many progressive forces did not see that they got blindsided. They focused on Texas textbook industry, which is very, very important because Texas is the largest textbook consumption in public schools in the country, then California, then New York, then Florida. So when textbooks are approved in Texas generally sets the norm across the country, those textbooks. There was a great underestimation of how the right was moving in other parts of the country to challenge the textbooks and offer up counter textbooks by big big and small textbook companies across the country. That was one aspect. The other thing that happened was the intellectual undermining of public educators. In other words, the education of teachers, the teaching of teachers, slowly but surely began to be undermined by many of the progressive educators retiring in the teaching colleges, or putting or being kicked to the curb, and younger, more conservative forces being brought in, compounded by this onslaught over the past 20 years of Teach for America, which is an instant teaching industry that drops mainly white teachers, uneducated white teachers, drops them into urban settings, i.e. black and brown schools, and expect them to teach. But in reality, they're really not expected to teach. They're there to discipline the unruly children, not necessarily educate them. Any education through Teach for America is incidental and accidental. So you have these forces coming along. You have the retiring all across the country of the first and second wave of black and brown educators in the public school system, most of them being replaced by younger whites who are not familiar with the culture and so forth. So the whole struggle in public schools around culturally progressive education gets kicked to the curb. The final nut happens when Trump gets in and has, as the head of the national education policy, a person who's never set foot in a public school, a multimillionaire, doesn't give a damn about working class people, no matter what color or gender. Under her watch, all of these right-wing things started to take off with federal support and federal funding all over the country. And all of the right-wing-led states started to do their thing. And so the foundation was laid. The spark that inflamed all this was the news pundits on Fox News, One America News, Newsmax, going out telling white people that their child is being taught to hate themselves, that this country was a terrible country, it was never a good country, and black people are superior, that the Native Americans had civilization, all these things that stirred up the Trump base, which we have to understand, the Trump base is somewhere around 70 million people, overwhelmingly white. If you just had 1% of them go out, go to meetings and scream and yell about the library and scream and yell about the school board being run by communists and all of that, and social media stirring it up all over the place, then you see the chaos that we see today. Then you understand that that's the chaos that we're witnessing, and that the progressive forces are in their weakest moment. We don't have a consolidated pushback from the Democratic Party, and we will not have that, the consolidated pushback from within Black America, and that's being worked on. We are beginning to see a consolidated pushback among the Latinx communities across the country, small but growing. We're beginning to see the Native American pushback, even though they're small in number, they're probably the strongest in terms of consolidation. So that's what we're facing with this whole onslaught to reverse what little progress was made in public education, what little progress was made to make critical thinking an essential component for the American citizen. We're seeing an attempt to not only erase, but to block that from ever happening again.
I've been speaking with Dr. Sam Anderson. Thank you for joining us. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Organize because another world is possible, and we are the ones to make it so.
Everyone is fighting for equal rights and justice. Palestine is fighting for equal rights and justice for equal rights.
And you're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so much for tuning in on Thursday mornings at 9 a.m., Equal Rights and Justice. It was a brilliant presentation by Dr. Sam Anderson. Brilliant overall, looking back at the history of Philip Agee. I cannot say strongly enough, I cannot ask you in any stronger terms than to make a contribution in support